Topic number 2. Earlier this month, on July 12, an unusual high-level meeting at the White House made some news. Key members of Congress had been summoned there by Jimmy Carter to discuss public disclosures of top-secret information. Present from Congress were ranking members of the Senate and House Committees on Intelligence, as well as Democratic and Republican Party leaders. In addition, the meeting included Secretary of State Vance, Secretary of Defense Brown, National Security Chief Brzezinski, and Admiral Turner, the head of the CIA. After the meeting, senators who were interviewed fumed as usual about damage to national security, quote-unquote, due to disclosures they refused to identify. But the key reason for this strange meeting is reflected in the following line from the New York Times report about it that day. Quote, "Today's meeting reportedly was originally scheduled for May or early June, when the administration was concerned about the disclosure of information in connection with the downing of a South Korean airliner in the Soviet Union." Unquote. My friends, the disclosures that provoked the White House meeting were those in my AUDIO LETTER 33 of 3 months ago. In that broadcast, I told you the complete story about the strange case of Korean Airlines Flight 902. It strayed into militarily sensitive Soviet airspace and was shot down while Secretary of State Vance was in Moscow. In my AUDIO LETTER for that month, I revealed that the Korean airliner episode was not accidental, but was an intelligence mission for the CIA, and I told you in detail why it was necessary. I told you these things, my friends, because you have a legitimate right to know. The Carter administration is boiling mad at me now for telling you, and would like nothing better than to silence the Dr. Beter AUDIO LETTER. Failing that, the government would like to cut off my sources. That was the underlying motive for the White House meeting of July the 12th. But, my friends, my most important intelligence sources are far higher than those currently available to any committee on Capitol Hill. And I can assure you that I told you nothing about the Korean 707 incident that was not already known within the walls of the Kremlin. As I told you in AUDIO LETTER 33, the United States no longer has any spy satellites in orbit that can observe the Soviet Union. A year ago this month, on July 17, 1977, the first in the new generation of Russian killer satellites called Cosmos Interceptors was launched. Called Cosmos 929, it was manned and armed with a charged particle beam weapon, a weapon which the United States tried but failed to develop. After 2 months of painstaking checkout and testing, it was used for the first time against an American target on September 20, 1977. As an American spy satellite passed directly over the Petrozavodsk Observatory in northern Russia, it was blasted into an enormous fireball in space by Cosmos 929. The fireball was witnessed over 300 miles away in Helsinki, Finland, and it made headlines in the United States as a strange jellyfish-like UFO. By that time, Cosmos 929 had been joined in space by Cosmos 954, which was armed with a neutron particle beam for a very special task. In the Battle of the Harvest Moon a week later, the crew of Cosmos 954 bombarded the American moon base in Copernicus Crater with neutron radiation that killed all of the male and female British, Canadian, and American astronauts there. Immediately on the evening of September 27, 1977, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko delivered an ultimatum to the White House. As I revealed that month in AUDIO LETTER 26, this was the reason for Gromyko's sudden, highly unusual nighttime meeting with Jimmy Carter and Secretary of State Vance. The following month, October 1977, there was an epidemic of fireballs in the sky, especially over Russia. 6 more Russian Cosmos interceptors were orbited that month, and they were shooting down America's spy satellites. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was on full military alert, and the United States was surrounded by almost the entire Russian submarine fleet in attack positions. Not all of the American satellites destroyed in October 1977 by Russia were mere spy satellites. As I revealed that month in AUDIO LETTER 27, the 85-ton space station called Skylab was shot down on October 18, 1977. This was done over the United States, creating a mammoth fireball that was witnessed in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Missouri. 9 days later, NASA began the cover-up about Skylab. The events from late September 1977 onward threw the controlled Carter administration to panicky confusion. By November 18, the situation with our dwindling spy satellites was becoming critical. On that day, the Voice of America was used to hurl a threat of preemptive war against Russia if destruction of our spy satellites did not stop. But the Russian Navy ended this desperate bluff by the Carter administration by swarming once again into position for a nuclear attack. Pressure on the controlled Carter administration mounted steadily through the end of 1977. But an unexpected stay of execution was brought about by the illness of Leonid Brezhnev, which ended with his death in Moscow on January 7, 1978. A few weeks later, Leonid Brezhnev No. 2, the ceremonial double seen in public these days, made his appearance. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the new top man in the Kremlin was rapidly emerging, although so far without public acknowledgment of the fact. His name? Marshal Dmitry Ustinov, the Soviet Defense Minister. After learning of the death of the real Brezhnev, our secret rulers began breathing a little easier, but wrongly so. They expected that there would be major power struggles within the Kremlin for 2 to 3 years before a clear, strong successor to Brezhnev could emerge. During that period of internal turmoil, Russia would be in a poor position to go to war in spite of her overwhelming military might. Meanwhile, the Rockefeller brothers believed it would be possible by means of crash weapons programs to construct a counter to the Russian threat. Even before Brezhnev's death, and even earlier than the disastrous loss of America's secret moon base, our secret rulers were taking measures to promote internal turmoil in Russia. When Brezhnev died, these measures took on added importance. A cardinal rule that the Rockefeller brothers have always followed is to support not only their faction in power, but also their opposition. This applies to their political intrigues everywhere, including the Soviet Union. In the wake of the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 2 years ago, the first reaction of the Rockefeller brothers was to try to undo the Russian double-cross and to reinstate the former secret alliance. But they also began preparing to unleash their own controlled opposition inside Russia against the present ruling faction in the Kremlin. A year ago this month, David Rockefeller made a secret trip to Moscow. While there, he did more than confer with leaders of the present regime. More importantly, he contacted his opposition leaders and instructed them to go all out to disrupt and undermine the present Russian regime. And back at home in the United States, the controlled major media were soon building up the dissident issue as never before. When Brezhnev died last January, the Rockefeller brothers were elated. It looked as if the old Rockefeller luck was going to see him through once again, as it had always done in the past. The protracted Kremlin power struggles that they anticipated were sure to hurt Russia's ability to wage war, and the internal distractions facing the Kremlin would be made worse by fast-building dissident agitation, which was to be highlighted in the Western press. All in all, the prospects for a breather in which to get new weapons in place looked very encouraging. But our secret rulers badly underestimated their Kremlin adversaries. The Rockefeller brothers simply do not understand the self-styled spiritual communists who run Russia today, about whom I first told you in AUDIO LETTER 28. They have an unprecedented unity of purpose and mutual respect that unites them, and as a result, Russian rulers were able to achieve a transition to a workable new structure of relationships within 2 months after Brezhnev's death. And so 6 months to the day after Gromyko delivered the Harvest Moon ultimatum at the White House, the new Kremlin leadership renewed that ultimatum. On March 27, 1978, Pravda warned that the United States was about to have its last chance to accept a SALT II accord, which was to be our surrender treaty. The Carter administration and its Rockefeller bosses were stunned. In incredibly short time, the Russians were signaling their readiness again to go to war, and here our rulers sat, stripped by then of all orbital surveillance capabilities over Russia by Cosmos Interceptor killer satellites. The result, as Secretary of State Vance went to Moscow to discuss SALT II, was the Korean Airliner intelligence mission that I explained for you in AUDIO LETTER 33. It's now clear to our secret rulers that they may have far less time to prepare for war than they hoped only a few short months ago. For it will not be internal turmoil that will dictate the timetable of Soviet actions, but Russian military strategy. This is the real message of the celebrated dissident trials of recent days. Bolshevik dissidents simply will not be tolerated. The Kremlin's concern is different in the case of dissidents like Alexander Ginzburg. Ginzburg is a practicing member of the Russian Orthodox Church. He is a reformer in the same vein as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who has spoken out publicly in Ginzburg's defense. As I explained last month, the Kremlin rulers of today are determined to take the lid off and promote spiritual rebirth in Russia, but they intend to do it in a gradual way that does not get out of hand. And so our secret rulers, the Rockefeller brothers, are finding themselves checkmated at every turn by the Russians. Crash weapons projects are underway, but there's no guarantee that there will be enough time for any of them to bear fruit. So in desperation, our rulers are now preparing to play the last card in their military deck. Last September 1977, the Battle of the Harvest Moon brought about a sudden dramatic shift in the East-West military balance in Russia's favor. Time is running out for the Rockefeller brothers, and nothing less than an equally sudden and dramatic shift in the opposite direction offers any hope for survival of the Rockefeller Empire. There's no time now to start from scratch on new military technologies to counter Russia. A few advanced weapons which have already reached readiness for production can be rushed ahead, but even that will be cut short by Soviet sabotage and other events. But there is one very major factor in the military equation which can be changed overnight, and that is strategy. As I've pointed out in other AUDIO LETTERS, the most powerful ingredient in any military strategy is surprise. And experience has shown that an aggressor attacking by surprise can often defeat an enemy that is vastly superior in strength. Our secret rulers have now concluded that this is the only way left against Russia. As a result, the United States of America has now embarked on a drastic new course that is without precedent in American history. For the very first time, the master military strategy of our secret rulers is for the United States to wage preemptive war against another nation. the Carter administration is moving as rapidly as possible now to position itself to launch a massive nuclear surprise attack on the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies. Over the past two decades, the so-called doves among Rockefeller agents, both in and out of government, have duped the American people into laying down our arms. Always we were told that our military strength might make the Soviets fear a first strike by us. But now that the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance has been dissolved by the new leaders in the Kremlin, we suddenly stand naked because of their treachery. And now it is the United States that is preparing for a first strike, not because of our strength, but because of our weakness. Having decided upon this last-ditch strategy, the Rockefeller brothers are making kamikaze pilots of every man, woman, and child in the United States. In connection with the new first strike strategy, the Carter administration is pouring thousands of personnel and equipment, especially aircraft, into Great Britain and Europe. Long abandoned airfields in England are being hastily reactivated over citizen protests there. Meanwhile, the Carter administration is doing everything it can to distract the Russians, while at the same time building up war tensions. If possible, the Rockefellers want their planned nuclear attack on Russia to appear justified or even defensive to the world. To this end, you should keep your eyes open for a major incident or series of incidents very soon. Just as in the case of the Korean 707 incident, my friends, I'm only relaying to you what the new Russian leaders already know. This is why the Kremlin is now adopting such public defiance of the West in the dissident trials and other matters. And this is why, just a few days ago, Pravda did not shrink from saying in so many words that we are heading for, quote, the cliffs of confrontation, unquote. Topic number 3. In the aftermath of Nuclear War I, the world as we know it today will have passed into history. Future generations, as they survey the century that preceded Nuclear War I, will be struck by the needless tragedy of it all, and by the mass blindness that made it inevitable. They will have difficulty even in comprehending the modern Western civilization of 1978, because that civilization will be extinct. But they will read, they will study, and they will learn. Historians of the future, of course, will be able to see clearly what is only dimly perceived today in 1978. They will be able to explain to their readers how, in the final months before Nuclear War I, both the United States and the Soviet Union adopted a preemptive war stance. They will explain how Russia and America stalked each other, like wrestlers preparing to grapple, each looking for a weak opening to begin the contest. And they will tell the sad story of how the West committed suicide by following the United States into a war we could not possibly win. It is only natural that tomorrow's history books will dwell at length upon the deaths and damage suffered by the Soviet Union in Nuclear War I. In this way, the major historians of that day to come will illustrate the heroism of the victorious side, Russia. But great attention will also have to be given to the enormous man-made cataclysm that engulfed the West. By comparison, the war sufferings of Russia will have been a mere scratch on the arm. In speaking of the ruined United States of America, the historians will speak in hushed and somber tones. America's epitaph will include the words, "preemptive nuclear war," quote unquote. It is this final suicidal American strategy that history will blame for the completeness of America's destruction. This suicidal strategy, my friends, has been brought about by the very forces of Bolshevism, whose absolute eradication has been vowed by the spiritual communists who rule Russia today. And history will relate that this plan will have removed the last ounce of restraint from Kremlin actions. Even for Russian historians, America's end will be a painful thing to describe, for Russia will ultimately employ all of her military resources in order to utterly destroy all traces of American military power worldwide. Not only missiles and bombers will be involved, but also the secret Soviet weapons I've told you about over the past 2 years. These include the short-range underwater nuclear missiles launched from our own territorial waters, radiochemical warfare in clouds dispersed from submarines and canisters at sea to bring on the totally artificial ailment now known as Legionnaire's disease, powerful microwave satellites which can derange the judgment of naval personnel just as was done to tanker crews over a year and a half ago, geophysical warfare shattering the Philippines and other military targets and laying waste America's west coast, charged particle beam superweapons fired at Earth targets from the 7 Russian bases that are already operational on the near side of the Moon, and, my friends, the Russian cosmospheres about which the late General Thomas Power tried in vain to warn America long ago, as I revealed in AUDIO LETTER 32, and which are now on battle stations over the United States targeting Air Force fields, dams, reservoirs, lakes, and other strategic points worldwide. And after all that, the invasion and occupation of what remains of America by the Soviet Army from staging points now being established in Canada and Mexico. The historians of tomorrow will move on to tell their readers how America's final desperate strategy of preemptive war led to selected nuclear and particle beam attacks on Europe and great devastation in England. Because, my friends, the Rockefeller shift to a first strike strategy is transforming all of our forces overseas into offensive invasion forces. For that reason, all American troop concentrations, military installations everywhere on Earth will be subjected to attack. In Europe, these attacks will be surgical in nature, sparing areas that do not harbor American forces. England, however, is working hand in hand with the Rockefeller brothers now and will be hit very hard. Yes, my friends, the final chapter in the history of modern Western civilization will have to be written by historians of another civilization which will survive the West. That civilization is the Eastern Orthodox Christian civilization centered on Russia. But as they close the book on the West as we know it, tomorrow's historians will begin writing a new, brighter chapter for mankind as a whole. The promise, contrary to the expectations of most, is for a rebirth of true human freedom in the age to come. The selfish and self-destructive license of today will be stamped out, but it will give way to real human freedom rooted in eternal spiritual values. Already the so-called spiritual communists who rule Russia today are making their plans for the future after they have disposed of the curse of Bolshevism worldwide. They have wrestled control of Russia away from the atheistic Bolshevik communists, and they have dissolved the former secret alliance between the Soviet Union and the Rockefeller rulers of America. They are striking out on their own now, and for years they have been quietly studying all the implications of such a course of action. For the long run, the most fundamental implications of severing Russia's ties with the United States are not military but economic. For most of the 6 decades following the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the Soviet Union depended for its very existence upon massive and continuing transfusions from the West. In past AUDIO LETTERS I reviewed all this in detail. But having severed these ties now, Russia must stand on her own 2 feet. Therefore the Kremlin has been actively pursuing economic studies in order to determine what course is the proper one to follow economically, and they are being objective about it because they know Russia's very survival depends on it. One of the most fundamental results of these Russian economic studies was mentioned last month by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his speech at Harvard. This item was not quoted in any of the major media reviews to my knowledge, but it was one of the most important points he made. I'm referring to the Russian mathematician who, as Solzhenitsyn said, proved 2 years ago that socialism in any form is inherently self-destructive, economically and otherwise. The present Kremlin rulers have accepted this verdict. And recently, Radio Moscow proudly announced that Russian agriculture, which used to be almost totally collectivized, is now up to one-third private enterprise. These are indeed turbulent times, my friends, and the day is not far off when the political scene we see today will be no more. But what about the economic scene for now? Many of you have written to ask where one can go to escape the coming war and to help preserve assets. My answer for now is that certain parts of Europe will be safe, such as southern France, Spain, and the tiny villages in the mountainous areas there. As you know, I've recommended several financial newsletters in the past which are written in the United States, but the one which I like best, which is published abroad, is coming out of a tiny country called Andorra, which is in the Pyrenees between Spain and France. I consider this newsletter to be the financial voice of Europe. It's called the IMAC, IMAC Commodities Newsletter. Free information about it is available by writing to CAPA, C-A-P-A, Mosson Tremosa 1, Andorra. The spelling is M-O-S-S-E-N, capital T-R-E-M-O-S-A, 1, Andorra, A-N-D-O-R-R-A, Europe. To give you an idea of what the IMAC Commodities Newsletter has to offer, I quote from the July 7, 1978 issue of the Professional Investor, which is a watchdog of the investment industry and published at Pompano Beach, Florida, zip 33061. Quote, IMAC has been consistently more accurate than most United States publications over the past 2 years in analyzing and forecasting the fate of the dollar, Wall Street, the United States economy, and gold. Perhaps even more interesting is the very astute political commentary offered gratis in most issues of IMAC. Don't let the word commodities in the title of the newsletter throw you off. While there is heavy emphasis on commodities, the letter covers far more. End of quotation from the Professional Investor. My friends, let no one suppose that the days ahead will be easy. For we are about to undergo a trial by fire, economically, politically, militarily, and spiritually. But like the rainbow that follows the storm, beauty and true human freedom will once again shine forth one day on the face of the earth. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.